John sits. John also stands, but mostly he sits. He sits on various benches provided for common use, in the park, outside the bus depot, in front of the public library. John does not sit in the middle of a bench, but always to one end. He sits at the end of one bench or another, bolt upright, hands on his knees, like a representation of piety or loneliness. John sits at the end of a bench, dressed in whatever discarded clothing has found its way to him, though he has a preference for dress shirts and hard-soled shoes, even when they are far too big for him. There are days when, thanks to a kind of combinatorial happenstance, John looks quite smart, dapper almost, like an eager applicant in the anteroom of some big city office, poised on the very threshold of prosperity. Most often, though, John looks like what people used to call a bum, it being somehow understood that this word tells the whole story. John is not a bum. John is a fallen being, the site of a great and abiding harm. Whether this harm preceded his entry into the world or befell him at some point thereafter, I cannot say, though I like to think that John is innocent of the nameless crime for which he suffers punishment. I've spent a great deal of time in John's company. I find him sitting to one end of an otherwise empty bench. John is not the kind of person most people choose to sit beside. I take a seat at the opposite end and place my hands, too, on my knees. Though John offers no obvious acknowledgement of my presence, I like to think he recognizes me, knows me, the way a plant knows the passing shadow which, every so often, brings a bit of water and a certain pleasant vibration. My only basis for this belief is the slight tremor that plays across John's otherwise expressionless face when I venture to say, my voice little more than a whisper, "Hello, John." This tremor, I like to think, is not just a coincidental, involuntary tick, but a spasm of hope, the anticipation of small kindnesses given and received. Sometimes, after I have left, John will find a paper bag on the bench beside him, inside of which he might be pleased to discover a sandwich, an apple, a bag of peanuts, a pair of new socks or a warm cap, or perhaps a flannel shirt freshly pressed and folded. John sits, and he also stands. He stands, menaced and alone, on a small concrete island in the middle of traffic. He stands beside the entrance of some building or other, puzzling over the secret of admittance. He stands on the sidewalk, haunting the departure of a bus he will never board, or the arrival of passengers he will never greet. Though I have never seen John in the act of walking, it is logical to assume that he does so. How else can he have made his way from the end of one bench or another to these stations of pedestrian purgatory? And yet, it is hard to imagine him voluntarily quitting his perch of a morning and making his way to an isolated traffic island or sidewalk swarming with people. Why would he do such a thing when it is so clearly painful to him? No, it must be that some malevolent spirit has plucked him from his seat and compelled him to submit to these pointless tortures. For while John's sitting is a picture of humility, of barely there-ness, John's standing is the very image of torment, inert, stiffened, as if fixed in a moment of palsy. His head hangs to one side like unused ballast, mouth pulled open at a corresponding angle. Arms pressed tight to his sides, his hands knock against his thighs. Above the sounds of traffic and heedless passersby, a quiet, broken moaning can sometimes be heard. I have never moved to deliver John from these moments of distress, though I have always wanted to. Instead, I stand at some distance and look on, willing John to rescue himself. Sometimes I simply continue on my way and hope for the best. I like to imagine that John is a collector of light. Light is free, after all, and John is thus welcome to as much of it as he wants. The golden warmth of the morning sun, the rosy backscatter of sunset on treetops and clouds, the lavender semaphore of televisions flickering through the windows of houses wherein well-fed families idle away their time, the titanium purity of the full moon, where the face of his oldest friend resides. John spends his time gathering this and any other available light. He draws it into himself, stuffs it into the pockets of his ill-fitting coat, holds it in his hand. It is this light, I like to think, that sees John through the night, shelters him during the long hours of darkness and isolation and threat. One morning not so long ago, I set out from my small apartment, paper bag in hand, to look for John. I found him on a bench in a nearby park. I approached the bench and, as quietly and humbly as possible, took my place opposite him. We sat in silence, hands on our knees, looking out at the world with open eyes. But only mine took in the pale light of winter, the tired steam rising feebly from manhole covers, the hopping about of hardy sparrows puffed up against the chill. I did not feel sad so much as empty, accused. The memory of light is no match for the pure fact of cold. I sat with John for a long while. Eventually, I forced myself to rise from the bench, already aware that I would leave him as he was. I took my paper bag and left. Other people would come along and know what to do. John would be taken care of now. That's how things work here. I walked slowly through the park, my head filled with empty consolation. The oft-repeated claim that freezing to death is accompanied by a sensation of warmth, for example. Or the possibility that something of John had moved on to a better place. Or that, at various moments in his life, John knew something like happiness. There is no way to know any of this, of course, any more than I knew that his name was John. There are just so many things I would like to believe.